This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore. And you know, one of the most fascinating aspects of Star Trek are the patterns and plot elements across all the episodes, movies, and franchises. And, you know, we like to delve into that a lot here on Standard Orbit. So today, Ken and I, in our never-ending quest to explore elements from a legacy show, explore the adventures that employ shuttlecraft.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking this, being a person that travels a lot, especially air travel, as Superman noted, it is the safest way to fly.
Statistically speaking.
Of course. I would have to say that flights in a Federation shuttlecraft is probably the riskiest thing you can do in the 23rd and 24th centuries.
Yeah, if you don't get kidnapped by Romulans, like on a on your way to a conference or something.
Right, right.
It's probably going to break down. is what we determined here. And so, you know, we're just going to talk about all the shuttlecrafts that are put in use in the original series, you know, and when crew members are put in danger, things of that nature. And, you know, one of the first things I want to establish off the top here is, from your understanding, do you think the original series shuttlecrafts had warp drive?
I did, and I think it was something that I thought back towards, right? So in the earlier episodes, I don't think I was paying that close attention, but as time went on, I think they had to have it. And I always considered those little nacelles that they had on the port and starboard sides were warp engines, mini warp engines. So yeah, I thought they did.
Yeah, I didn't think they did. I thought it was one of those evolutionary things, like Next Gen, right? The shuttlecraft had transporters, you know, which I think from a storytelling technique opened a whole new can of worms, right? Because once, oh, sir, the transporters are down, right? Well, just use all the transporters in the shuttles. You know, it's its own independent thing. So I think it was smart how 2S didn't have that. And I guess I always looked at the nacelle caps being white, you know, and not red, like the buzzard collectors, as they went on to be called. I thought that was an indicator that they didn't have warp drive. But I guess if you look at some of these episodes, as we'll get into it here, they must have had to, like, to travel the distances they did and get as far as they did. That's one of the great, as we love to talk about, the inconsistency of Star Trek right there. Because some episodes really does seem like they just have thrusters or impulse, and others they're just trying to chase the Enterprise. So, which is in our first episode here, we'll talk about the Menagerie. We have Kirk and who what we were led to believe at the time is Commodore Mendez chasing after the Enterprise, and a big deal is made that they're going to run out of power, they're going to run out of life support. Spock does not want to turn around because he's on a mission to Talos IV to take Captain Pike there, and he knows that if, you know, Kirk catches up with him, he's going to be in trouble, so he's trying to ignore him. But the very fact that they're put into danger is why Spock stops the ship, turns around, and we get the episode that we do. So, and we brought this up in our last episode, interestingly enough, talking about, you know, court martials and trials and whatnot. But, you know, Kirk makes a note about the life support in there. I guess maybe he didn't realize that there was only one person in that shuttlecraft and not two. That's its own conversation.
Well, that's not a probably.
So you do wonder, like, that shuttle is it's like a 10-seater, you know, it's like a it's a giant shuttlecraft and there's two guys in it, and they're really going to run out of life support just because they're pushing the engines, giving it all she's got to catch up with the Enterprise, I guess. So that is one I don't know if it's a design flaw. It's just because the shuttlecraft, I mean, it's a shuttle. Like, you take a shuttle bus somewhere, you take a shuttle van somewhere. It's supposed to be a short-term form of transportation. Clearly, they're not designed to chase after, you know, the top-of-the-line starship. So I understand why their energy reserves would be encased there. But that is just a case of someone being in a shuttlecraft and therefore being in danger. And that's a trope that we'll find across Star Trek.
Yes, we will. And I think that it launches well with this episode. And it starts all the questions, right, in terms of what you're talking about. Does it have warp drive? How does energy get captured? What is it using for fuel? We don't really know, do we?
Where's the warp drive engine? Like, underneath, like, you know, the episodes where Scotty's, like, underneath the shuttle, firing a phaser down there, whatever that does.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it was underneath the floor. Yeah, yeah. No, it is interesting because the capabilities of the shuttle based on, you know, how it's designed and all that other stuff. You're right. It as soon as you said it's like a bus, I said, you know, that's a great way of looking at it because it's got a lot of seats. It's not designed for comfort or at all. And, you know, it's to get from A to B in a short period of time, but it doesn't have, you know, and even though it's designed to land on planets and travel through atmosphere, and it may hit something called turbulence, they don't have seat belts either. And you know, you've seen it, right? You've been up close and personal because the Galileo 7 / Copernicus / whatever the other names that they've used is sitting in Houston, Texas, right? So obviously NASA captured it and it spun around the sun at one point.
Which means it must have warp drive if it went right around the sun to the time warp, right? So
yeah. So what you need to do is to, you know, steal a shuttle, which in Star Trek is very easy. Now NASA might have better security protocols. I don't know, but it does seem like it is very relatively easy to steal a shuttle. Take that thing for a ride and let us know what it can do.
You know, if Star Trek has taught me one thing, it's extremely easy to steal a shuttlecraft.
That's right.
Because this is a trope. We'll see, you know, we see it in the Doomsday Machine. We see it in The Way to Eden, in the original series anyway.
So do you want to, I mean, you're only, what, 20 minutes from there, half an hour? If you want, we can pause the show and from right here, and then you can come back and let us know what that shuttle could do. Just don't get caught. And if you don't come back, I know you got caught.
Ken, am I to understand you believe this is an operational shuttlecraft?
Well, I've seen it fly, haven't you?
Okay, we're going to have to talk after the podcast, but that's okay. Let's. I think there's a lot of things. We have much to discuss.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to talk after the podcast. I think it's bad news, and I don't handle bad news well.
All right. Well, listeners, just I'll handle this with Ken. Just carry on, and we'll get him back on track come next week's show. But
there we go.
Anyway, but no, that is a trope across Star Trek, stealing shuttlecraft. I mean, I feel like in like Next Gen, it happened all the time. Like Worf would be like, "Sir, there's a unauthorized launch from the shuttle bay." It's like, well, can we close? Oh, they're gone. It's like, can we have a more advanced warning system than, oh, look, the shuttle just left? Like there should be, like, because the equivalent would be, can you know? From your worldview, I'm sure you can talk to this. Stealing like a plane, like a fighter jet off an aircraft carrier, right? I mean, that's got to be pretty difficult, right? You gotta get past the security. You gotta start the ship up. You gotta prep for launch. You gotta get past, you know, all the whatever barriers there are to take off, because you know you gotta go through proper clearance for this stuff. You know, and it just seems so easy in the trusting 23rd and 24th centuries for people to just steal a shuttlecraft from a ship. I mean, it should be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it should be. And I mean, you have tractor beams that can grab and repel asteroids, but they can't catch those little bloody shuttles once they get stolen either. So it is kind of funny how that all works. And I do get a kick out of it from time to time. I mean, in some cases, particularly in TNG, you know, you do have some clever reasons why they were able to do it. But in others, you're just like, it's a kid. It's a kid, and he's in a shuttle. How did
a very smart kid.
Not in one episode, it wasn't.
So, well, he was what? That guy, coming of age in TNG, he was the second, like he got second place to in the Academy entrance exam after Wesley. And Wesley's like freaking genius, child genius. So give the guy some credit. But anyway, yeah, you got aliens who aren't even familiar with Starfleet technology.
Yeah, yeah, but they have access to anywhere on the ship, and that's hey, it's the same in TOS. You know, they just don't have the types of protocols you would expect. You know, hi, I'm a super being from the past, and I would just like to read up on all the technical specifications of this ship. Well, sure, here you go. Just anything you want.
We take you on a tour. You want to see the battle bridge? But anyway, moving on. So again, this is interesting. I bring this up a lot in our conversations here on Standard, but production order versus broadcast order. So in production order of TOS, they made the Galileo 7 first. But in broadcast order, according to my notes here, because I wasn't there, Ken. You were. You tell me.
Okay, but I was really little.
But according to my notes here, the Menagerie aired before the Galileo 7, which is why we brought it up first. But that's interesting. Just they introduced the concept of a shuttlecraft like that. Like, because clearly the Galileo 7 was supposed to be the showcase show for the shuttlecraft. I mean, I think that episode is why the shuttle is such a most beloved, memorable prop and part of the franchise. You know, I mean, we have Christmas ornaments about it. Like, I've mentioned it before in the past. It's like one of my favorite Christmas ornaments is the Hallmark ornament with the little Spock, Leonard Nimoy voice on it. It's great. But Galileo 7, right? Let's talk about it. The title, what does it refer to? In your opinion,
I thought it referred to the number of people on the shuttle. That's what I thought it referred to.
And I think it could.
It could.
But also, the shuttlecraft is the Galileo 7. Like the numbers, I assume that is the seventh shuttlecraft, right? That would be, it's in, like the registry is NCC 1701 dash or slash or whatever.
Apostrophe seven.
So it could go either way. You know, I mean, it's either the Galileo 7, like the ship, or. Them and it's a title like the Magnificent Seven, but the Galileo Seven. You
know, that's so right.
You could look at it either way. So it's one of those titles that can cut both ways. It's we had an episode talking about episode titles. I don't know what it is, but and my classic non recall. As good as my recall is about like Star Trek itself, my recall about Standard Orbit is just the opposite end of that spectrum because I don't know what it was titled. I don't know what the number it was, but we need to like. Make a cheat sheet for me or something, Ken. Can you get on that in your spare time?
I know you're. I'll get on that. What I think we need to do is just create a Standard Orbit Wikipedia page, right? And then you can just click on it. You'll know the episodes. You'll have the descriptions, all that other stuff. We could have a great time putting that together because we have so much extra time in our lives just to sit there and poke it up. But wouldn't that be fun to go to Wikipedia and see Standard Orbit?
Perfect. And we should have a list of broadcast order and list of production order. Of the episodes as well.
Yes. Yeah, we could have the famous, the rumors of the lost tangents and what those subjects were that got cut out and disappeared into the, into the stratosphere, never to be heard from again.
That's true. Yeah, I loved our feedback on the last show because people were asking us about this or that. And I was like, yeah, Ken had some tangents, but I cut him out. And
guys, some of our shows would go for like 3.5 hours if we got out some of the tangents.
We don't want to be here that long. We don't want you to be here that long. So it's anyway. But I'll try to give you more voice in the tangents, Ken. I know I kind of monopolize those sometimes. So please tangent away, my friend.
Well, hey, I did have plenty to fill. As you were recovering and getting things back in order, I got plenty of shows in there. I was able to go on plenty of tangents, so I'm fine. It's okay.
Yeah, the last 2 months has been a Ken tangent. Come on, people.
That's right. Come on. It's just been it's trip ahoy here. Let's go.
But yeah, but talking about the Galileo 7, I think it's very impressive. They had a full size prop. As well as a model, so that's very rare for TOS, So to see something like that, and I think that really added a lot of believability to it. It wasn't just like a light in the sky flying. Oh, look, the shuttlecraft! We get to see it launch from the shuttle bay. We get to see it land on the planet. We get to see Scotty in the back there. I was mentioning him like firing phasers down there. I don't know what he's doing, but I mean he's a genius. He's a miracle worker. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. And it wasn't so much the shuttle. Was a problem with the shuttle. It was a problem with like a planet, right, or the nebula or the quasar they were exploring.
That's
interfered
right.
with their normal operations. Although I do question the complement of this team. This is neither here nor there, but it's classic TOS. Like let's have the first officer, the chief medical officer, the chief engineer, and then a couple of blue shirt, red shirts, and a yeoman. And it's like, is this really the complement of crew we need for a mapping mission? But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But they created this way, and that's why we have so many shuttlecraft stories across the franchise, because you want to isolate characters, put them in a certain situation that can lead to specific drama, you wouldn't otherwise get. And that's why we get Spock getting his quote-unquote first command in this episode.
That's right. That's right. So, good episode. I think it introduces us to a shuttle that we didn't know we have from another episode. And it allows, I think, the functionality of the ship to come full circle, right? Because it was designed with a shuttle bay right from the very beginning. There's no doubt about that. And I think it's built correctly. And I think, you know, there's a lot of attributes to the Enterprise that are just done so well that carry on very well throughout the rest of the series. And I mean, all the other franchises. And in designing what I think is a very practical, workable vessel, you know, for the jobs that they're doing. It's ironic, right? Because in the Next Generation, everything got bigger except the shuttles, right? They got smaller, more functional, you know, like these little smart car type shuttles, you know, that blast between little ships and stuff to bring, you know, highly volatile products from one ship to another.
That's Data's another dead.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Boom. Anyway, so it is, and I'm not saying that's wrong or right. It's just interesting. But I think the initial shuttle design, if you look at just like the Enterprise itself, the attributes of the starship and the attributes of the shuttle don't change all that dramatically. They're modernized, but it's kind of the same idea throughout all of the series.
And there's only so many ways to design a shuttlecraft, you know, especially a Federation style. Even when you see other aliens have shuttlecraft, like it's basically the same thing, you know, I mean, more or less. So it's basically the Star Trek franchise design of spacecraft versus, you know, this race or that race or whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Star Wars has a unique design. And the original series, Battlestar Galactica, had the ugliest shuttles ever invented. They were awful. Oh,
the Vipers? You don't like them?
No. Vipers are fighters. I said shuttles.
Oh, okay. I can't even remember what they.
Yeah,
what they
look like. You'll look it up and you'll go, ugh.
Not instantly. they're not refurbishing those and putting them in Space Center Houston. Okay,
That's right. They are not. They are not. So anyway, we move on. What's our next episode?
So the next episode really would be the Doomsday Machine.
Mm-hmm.
That episode, of course, Commodore Matt Decker steals a shuttle.
Steals a shuttle. He's supposed to be in sick bay, correct?
Yeah. It's very funny. Like he acts like he's getting escorted off the bridge by the security guards, and he like leans over and acts like he's gonna cough, and then he like beats up these security guards. I'm like, good for you, man. Like he's got some Kirk Fu in him too.
He did have some damn good Kirk Fu in him.
But he steals the shuttle and he wants to fly it into the. Well, what was his plan? Like obviously he gets sucked into the Doomsday Machine from the tractor beam, but I mean it was a suicide mission because he had failed to like redeem himself for getting his ship destroyed because he thought, oh, I have the Enterprise now, I'm gonna fire at point blank range quicker and we're gonna get this thing. Didn't work. So then at that point he's probably like he's at the end of his rope and he just decides to do what he can with the shuttle. As it turns out, unintentionally, his sacrifice ends up showing Kirk and company how to defeat Doomsday Machine. Luckily, they have this other ship they can use for that same purpose. Because you know, once the shuttle explodes inside the ship, the Doomsday Machine, they notice a power level drop and they realize, oh, if we do this exponentially larger, which we can with a ship, we can shut this thing off. And this also proves that the shuttle has some kind of warp capability because it was something with like, you know, that matter, antimatter.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, it had some element of a power source that was disruptive and it gave them a clue as to how they could attack this thing. And it was ironic, too, because the shuttle that was stolen from the Enterprise was the exact same size as the Constellation. And at least it looked that way when it was heading into the maw of the machine.
Perspective, right?
poor technology back then. Man, oh, man, they tried. They really tried. But at any rate, it was one of my favorite episodes, top five anyway. And it was one of those things, too, where there's a lot of parallels to a new series that we're seeing now with Commodore Decker. But at any rate, it was really well done, and it showed that the shuttle, once again, could be a trigger point for either solving something or, you know, continuing a plot line on. And I think we see more of that as we move forward with the other episodes that involve using a shuttle.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about three episodes so far. The first one, the shuttle, was run out of power.
Run out of power, yep.
The second one, it was it did run out of power and it blew up. And then there's the original Galileo we're referring to. And then in this one here, it gets blown up by the Doomsday Machine. So we're kind of 0-3
yeah, so
on
we've
Shuttle
had,
so far.
Yep, three episodes. Well, the Shuttle survives in the menagerie, right? They do pull it in. So it does pull it in. It does get, you know, I'm guessing it gets gassed back up or whatever. And, you know, Scotty probably put some, you know, tiger teeth on the side, maybe some flames, you know, made it a little sexier. But so, right, three episodes, two down. That's how
well,
I look at it.
Well,
right
here's
now.
The thought about the menagerie shuttlecraft. It's from Starbase 11, right?
Right.
So Kirk gets to the Enterprise with it. There's, remember, there's no Commodore Mendez, so there's no reason to go back to Starbase 11 because they don't have to return anyone, right?
That's right.
Does the Enterprise go and return the shuttle, or do you think they just keep it?
No, finders keepers all the way. Yeah, lot of the same. Yeah.
Look, if you guys, we're not going to be a shuttle for your shuttle. Okay, so if you guys want to come get it, great. But we got a 5-year mission to go explore things, seek out new life, a new civilization. That's not part of our job description. Ferrying around, we will ferry around diplomats, but not shuttlecraft.
Hey, okay, that's the law of the sea, law of space. All right.
Now you just think about that when they pick up random things, like it's got to be out of their way, you know, because they have a mission already to divert. Anyway. Neither here nor there. Moving on to the next episode that we see the shuttlecraft featured in, the Metamorphosis. Now, this is the Galileo 2, because, you know, of course, the Galileo blew up, Galileo 7. It's not Galileo A. That's Galileo Roman numeral 2. I guess they figured it was pretty easy to just paint a number 2 on the side of the shuttlecraft. Fine by me. And this episode has, you know, we're talking about Galileo 7. In classic 2S fashion, we have the captain, the first officer, and the chief medical officer escorting a diplomat until they get delayed by the companion. Now, the shuttle, you know, it's forced to land on this planetoid. It's not the shuttle's fault. It's this, you know, powerful alien, the companion, that's caused it to land. So we really can't fault the Starfleet engineers here. But again, this episode, it's to isolate these characters from the rest of the ship. There's a lot of episodes where they put some shield up or communications get cut off, but still the ship is in orbit and the people are on the planet below. Episodes like this, Galileo 7, you isolate certain characters and you get certain drama that can take place outside of those normal storytelling points. So there's an effective use of the shuttlecraft there, storytelling-wise.
I think so, a very effective way. And, you know, in many ways, Metamorphosis, which is another great kind of, you know, under the radar episode for many reasons. It's the Star Trek 3, in my opinion. There's so many things that come out of this episode that is used from now on in legacy Star Trek that, you know, for folks that haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while, rewatch it. It really opens up a lot of things, you know, not only just with Zefram Cochran, but all kinds of technology and
universal translator,
things like that. So it's kind of cool. And
we should do an origins episode on that, Ken. That you mentioned. That's a good call out, man.
Yeah, we could do that. And the thing too with this episode with the shuttle once again, I do like the fact that, like I said, you can utilize this as a plot device to either enhance a story, and bring it in the fold, because it does allow too this the As I think, as Bill Shatner said, you know, the actors that are below the line, you know, they got to go find them, and so that's kind of cool, right? You know, you don't have anyone on board, and that's common, but usually they're just in orbit.
Exactly.
So I always like those episodes when even though it's very very small, they get to utilize the rest of the crew a little bit, and you know, the fact that they can function and they can do things without the big three on board. But yeah, I really liked this episode, and the shuttle did what it needed to do. It wasn't because the shuttle had any mechanical problems or whatnot. It was just overwhelmed, and no, it was effective.
The shuttle lives.
Shuttle lives. Okay, that's four episodes, two dead shuttles, two living shuttles.
I'm glad you're keeping a tally there. So the next episode we see it in is actually the very next episode in broadcast order, Journey to Babel. And this is probably the most routine of any of the times we see a shuttle, because it's they're shuttling diplomats up to the Enterprise. It's as simple as that. They're in the hangar deck, and I believe this is the first time we see the hangar deck itself properly. We'd seen, as far as like characters and actors interacting with the shuttle bay and whatnot. We had seen, you know, the footage of the shuttle rotating around and launching and all that good stuff in earlier episodes. But this time, you know, we see Sarek and Amanda kind of get off the shuttle, make the long walk towards the doors as Spock tries to show McCoy how to do the Vulcan salute. So it's a nice classic moment there in Star Trek. And that's really all there is to say about the shuttle in this episode. It shows up, does its job. It's just a tool in the background, and there it is. So they don't make much fanfare about it, but there it is. And it's interesting that they, thinking about this, it's interesting that they chose to use the shuttle in this episode. I guess they had it laying around from the last episode. Like, hey, just wheel it over to this set. We'll use it. Because that conversation could have easily took place in, like, the transporter room, right? They're waiting for the delegation from Vulcan to beam up or something, right? And they could have been just standing there in their dress uniforms. And, you know, I think about the TNG episode Sarek, because I watched that not too long ago. You know, Kirk and Picard Picard and Riker, they're walking to the transporter room and they're talking about Sarek and whatnot. And, you know, you could have done that here as well. So, no right or wrong way about it. I like how they mix things up some, you know, than just the standard. Let's wait here and see if this were season three. They just would have beamed up, basically, especially near the end of season three. So
even though it was a short scene, there's a couple of things you take away from that. One, the functionality of the ship, right? You know, the cargo bay has to be pressurized, just like, you know, if you were taking on a vessel into a submarine, right? You gotta open the airlock and flush all the water out. In this case, you have to recompress the shuttle bay, and I think that's kind of cool because that's how it would work in theory. You know, I understand as time goes on, you have force fields that, you know, adapt to the shape of the shuttle when it leaves the ship. But it also goes back and talks about a little bit what we were talking about before. It should be really, really difficult to steal a shuttle. It should be really difficult because you have to decompress a shuttle bay. It takes time. When you look at the shuttle bay, there's windows, there's a deck. Even in Star Trek V, there's a deck that overlooks, you see it for the first time, the shuttle bay. So, you know, there is one there. So, you know, obviously, you know, Schmedlap and Umpty Scratch just sleep. They, you know, there's not a lot going on in the shuttle bay, you know, because there's 79 episodes and there's about 6 or 7 instances where we see a shuttle. So,
well, I like that. That's the attention to detail you're not going to see on other sci-fi shows. Yeah, the depressurization. I remember seeing that. It was like a big, at the time when I was a kid, I equated it to a big temperature gauge, you know, just the way it looked. And you're not going to see that on, say, Battlestar Galactica or Space 1999, right? So again, Star Trek paving the way for scientific accuracy when it comes to space adventures. So.
They did. And I thought that was pretty cool. And it's, you know, it's realistic. So, okay.
Cool. Well, Journey to Babel. We'll close on that one. You know, the next time we see a shuttle is the Immunity Syndrome. Ken, I know this is one of your favorite episodes, so if you want to speak to the use of the shuttle in this one.
Yeah, you know, in this case, it's definitely a tool to solve a problem, to get more data, you know, to puncture its way into a living cell that is now infecting or could mutate and infect the whole galaxy. And in this case, you know, it's Spock being the hero. It has a doomsday machine feel to it because it, you know, definitely make it known that this is an extraordinarily dangerous mission. They lose communication, and then, you know, Spock kind of kicks it in the side to let him know that he's alive, and they're able to pull him back and save the shuttle. But, you know, to me, this was a great instrument. You know, you have more and more use of probes and things along those lines in future shows. And they have them on the Enterprise, but they don't utilize them much. But in this case, you know, this was a good plot, I thought, overall. I thought it was it's one of the most brilliantly written Star Trek episodes, right? We get to see that there are other Federation ships that are manned completely by the species. In this case, you know, a Vulcan ship, the USS Intrepid, and they all die because they can't logically figure out what is happening to them, which in and of itself I thought was brilliant. But the use of the shuttle in this case was very well done, and I think it completed a brilliant story arc. I really do.
Yeah, and this, again, the shuttle being used in a creative way, you know, because we've talked about a lot of shuttle episodes here, and they're not all the same thing. They're all very different. So I give them credit for finding creative ways to use the shuttle throughout the show. And this one survives as well, So we got, what are we at now? What's our tally here on the shuttle?
Uh-oh, I've lost count. We gotta go back here, right? So we got the Menagerie, we got the Galileo 7, we got the Doomsday Machine, we've got Metamorphosis. I'm not going to count Journey to Babel in this. So I guess we've got 6 episodes, still only 2 shuttlecrafts that have been destroyed. Not bad.
So the talking about people stealing shuttles and whatnot, the really last time we see a shuttle, I mean, we see one in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, but it's not the Enterprise's shuttle. You know, Loki steals one from a starbase and kind of stumbles out of it because, low on power, right? So low on life support. Again, this kind of goes to show that it does have warp drive because they found it out in open space and it had been stolen a couple weeks ago or something. So something like that. But again, to our conversation, I bet they just keep that shuttle. They don't go back all the way to Starbase 4 or whatever just to return the shuttle. There's now. Like, do you think they repaint it and like rename it too? Like if they change the registry and all that, they got to re-register the title and registration for the Enterprise.
You've got to keep the people that work the flight deck busy. Okay, so why not?
Cool.
Why not?
So that's that one. And then the last time we see the shuttle again, the Galileo 2, would be in the way to Eden, where guess what? People steal a shuttle.
I can't believe they got away with it. It's incredible.
I did enjoy, though, when they took the shuttle craft set to the planet set.
Yeah.
Yep. Just added another sense of just, I don't know, a sense of something. You know, something different than like, oh, here we are in front of the cyclorama with this plastic rock. Like, oh, but the shuttlecraft is here too. So it just makes it look more legit. And that pretty much wraps up the use of the shuttlecraft on the original series. Again, you know, an iconic prop. I did get to see it. I have seen it multiple times at the Space Center Houston down here in Houston. I recommend if anybody has a chance to check it out. I mean, you can go up, you can touch it, take your picture with it. I mean, it's a key piece of Star Trek mythology and history, and so much of what the original series was lost. Like the bridge set was, you know, thrown away basically, and so many props and little things survive. But this is like, I mean, they did a great refurbishing job on this shuttle, and then they really do it justice there at Space Center in Houston. And Star Trek Continues, the fan series, the excellent fan series, I might add, has used it a couple times. They used it in Lolani. As well as Ferris of the Mall, and it's the actual shuttle. I mean, they use the shuttle from how much more legit can you get than to use the actual shuttlecraft they used? And then they actually have another interior shot of the shuttle in Winds of Change, I believe. There another episode of theirs. So they make good use of the shuttle as well. So anyway, just an iconic piece of Star Trek history that I have hanging on my Christmas tree every year with the voice of Leonard Nimoy as Spock in it. So, but moving on to the movies. The main movie that uses the shuttle more than any film by far is Star Trek V, your favorite Star Trek movie, Ken. So if you want to speak to the use of the shuttle in this one.
It is not my least favorite Star Trek movie. How's that? Pretty good.
That's not my least favorite either.
Okay, so there we go. So it's up there. It's not on the bottom. But, you know, I thought a couple of things. One, the design of the shuttle, I think, is really well done. And the use of the shuttle is practical and needed. I guess the approach they took so that they had to use the shuttle just didn't work because, you know, the suspension of disbelief in order to watch a movie, and I think this is where Star Trek V struggles on 2 front, right? It didn't have a great script. It had some great scenes, but it didn't have a great script. And they were they worked too hard to try to take the natural comedic flow that we had in Star Trek IV and put it into Star Trek V, and it became, you know, the Star Trek Stooges. You know, it's like, come on, you know, the slapsticky with the ship and the funny voices and the springs popping out, and, you know, none of that is...
Well, but that plays into, and I agree, I think they analyzed Star Trek IV being so successful, and they said, there's comedy in it, let's do comedy again. It's like, no, that works in one specific set of circumstances. You can't bring that back into the, you know, 23rd. If you look at Star Trek IV, the opening and closing acts are very serious, very straightforward, very Star Trek. You know, and there was a sense of humor, as there always was, but the middle acts, you know, that Nick Meyer wrote in the 80s, that's where the comedy was. So they tried to take that comedy from the 80s and put it in the 23rd century. It didn't work. But because they had the broken down ship... and no transporters, that led to the use of the shuttlecraft so much in this movie. And they use it so much. They use it at shore leave, you know, to pick up the guys from the park. They use it when they go to Nimbus 3, and they use it when they get back on the Enterprise and Plan B, Barricade. That's and then right. They use it to go to Nimbus 3. So they really get their money's worth.
They do
out of the shuttle. Now, how much money they had to spend That's another question entirely, right?
Yeah, well, when they couldn't use Lucasfilm to drive the effects, it really hurt them, you know? And you know, they used a guy who made commercials, I guess, Brad Farron, whatever his name was, to do it, and it just didn't work. And it's a shame because visually, I think it would have been really cool in a Star Trek movie because, you know, they don't do a lot with the effects, but in the movies they always did more and they always look pretty good. I mean, from the motion pictures brilliance to, you know, Star Trek 2 and 3 and the space dock and all this. It was really, really neat. In Star Trek 4, they weren't, special effects heavy at all. It's just a couple of scenes. From a space perspective, they did a lot of work with the visuals and the whales. I give them credit there. And ILM did a brilliant job. And then you have Star Trek V, and they wrote a script, like I said, where they tried to make it slapsticky, and it didn't work. They are naturally funny as a crew anyway, just with their interactions. You know, I think of Star Trek II in particular, and you know, one of the best lines is, you know, Jim, be careful, and with McCoy saying, "We will." Yeah, and you know, that's the humor that you expect on the ship, is the kind of the banter that goes back and forth, not the walking into pipes and the things breaking and the chair being creaky and, you know, and a ship that has basically nobody on it going on a rescue mission. It just doesn't work. The shuttles do, but then the effects team, you know, they can't capitalize on it. They can't make it work. When the shuttle lands, when they come back from the camping trip, I mean, it looks like TOS effects. I mean, it was just horrible. The way it plopped. The set was gorgeous, though, right? When the shuttle pulls in and, you know, you have the crewmen walk over with the steps to welcome the team home and so that they can step down and all that stuff. It's kind of neat. Not very practical, but it's kind of neat. So it's hit or miss. The shuttle design, though, is outstanding. The use of the shuttle is outstanding. The effects and watching them fly and all that stuff was just subpar, and that's really what took away from the movie.
Well, and this shuttle design is used for TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, or at least a variation of it. I think this is like the Type 5 shuttle, and the one they use in TNG era is Type 7, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure someone out there will correct me, but it's kind of cyclical because, you know, TNG, because we always like delve into this behind-the-scenes stuff here, TNG reused a lot of motion picture era sets. Repurposed, and then Star Trek 5 and 6 repurposed a lot of TNG sets for themselves, and they both kind of shared this, you know, shuttle design. So it's just the snake eating itself of Star Trek production, right? But yeah, I think it's a good design. I'm obviously it's not as iconic as the Galileo, but yeah, there's two shuttles in Star Trek 5. There's the Galileo, which they use to go down to Nimbus 3, and then crashes into the the shuttle bay there. You know, and for Sulu's first attempt, I think he did okay. then after that, there's the Copernicus, I believe it is. The second shuttle that they go land on Nimbus 3. Shakari. And then they walk for like, you know, 5 miles to go find quote unquote God. You know, could God have not parked the ship a little closer to where he wanted to? Because, I mean, Spock is like, I have no control. So God landed, God, again. Little G quotations, sorry, no blasphemy here on Standard Orbit. But, you know, God landed the ship, and then he made them walk like 5 miles, right? You think he wanted to, like, move things along. He's been trapped on this, you know, planet for, like, an eternity. He wants to get out of there. He's going to make these guys walk, like, 5 miles to go find him. And then when they fire the torpedo, now the shuttle's very far away, so it's fine, because they go hide in the shuttle afterward. But then he gets zapped with his laser beam. So I'm going to count both of these shuttles as... What do you want to do? 1.5 damage shuttles on this one? Because the one that crashes into the shuttle bay gets damaged, and then this one gets, I'm going to assume it gets blown up real good by those laser beams, eye beams.
At least, you know, causes a fire on the inside of the shuttle because Kirk jumps out and shoot, but you don't actually see the shuttle go boom, which in itself would have been kind of a cool effect, I think.
Well, they were short on money. That's why we had no rock men. We had... overhead projector blue godhead flying around shooting Kirk with laser beams. So
you, sorry,
that was pretty good, Ken. That was good. But yeah, we stay tuned, guys. We might be talking about the production of Star Trek V more in depth coming up here.
Hey, why not?
In weeks ahead. So, but yeah, but I think it was good to see the shuttle used so much because, you know, when you think of Star Trek, you do think of shuttlecraft because the Galileo is so iconic. And to have it play a major role in a movie was a good angle. And I think, you know, as cheesy as some of the humor was, we're talking about you have to have that excuse that the transporters don't work because otherwise, why would you be using the shuttle? Like, there's just no logical reason to do it. Because if there's like a shield around the planet you can't beam through, you certainly can't fly a shuttle through it either. So you know, there's a very limited, like, understandable window of why you would use a shuttlecraft. And I think, you know, that's they figured out a way to use it. All that being said, could they have saved a lot of money not using the shuttle and used it in the climax of the film? You know, maybe that would have been better, but I don't know.
Yeah, hard to say. I think that the economy of scale on this would have been, like I said, a lot better. If ILM had this and they, you know, I don't know how the budget really got away from them from a special effects. You know, this was a movie that was shot on location in a lot of different places. And, you run up a budget like that. And, you know, Shatner was looking for an epic type film, you know, a lot of horses, a lot of this, a lot of that, built a town, you know, so it's hard. And then when you're coming towards the end and it's like, okay, we had all these epic shots. Now we want an epic quote unquote ending and you can't afford it. Well, that's a big letdown. And I think they did the best they could. Again, if they had ILM, they could have come up with effects, even if they used a floating godhead, that would have been a lot better, you know. And we didn't have CGI to the point where we have today either, and it probably would never have held up. But, you know, it's one of those things, Zach, where, again, you know, the movie, the intent was good. It just failed on the execution. And you can't make, you know, for all the movies, all the Star Trek movies that there are, were there 12, 13? I don't even know the real number. You know, they did a pretty good job, specifically, I think, with the original series movies, holistically, 1 through 6, they're all pretty good, you know, standalone wise, you know, Star Trek 5 being at the bottom of that list, in my opinion. But, you know, they did a pretty good job for that kind of a string of movies. I'm trying to think, you know, were there 6 great James Bond movies in a row? And Star Wars, right? I mean, there's a lot of arguments about their first 6. It's just hard to say. And there's a lot of opinions going both ways. But, you know, in Star Trek V, it was good premise, I thought. They could have made this work. The script just didn't quite hit. But the use of the shuttles, what we were talking about before, would have been really iconic and fun if they had the money to do it right with the right company.
Thanks, Indiana Jones. Gosh.
Thanks, Indiana Jones. I missed that.
Because ILM was working on Last Crusade.
Oh, is that was the reason?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, Last Crusade was a good movie, though.
Well, there you go. Well, there's...
Okay, I'm not bad. Well, if they said it was Temple of Doom, I would have went, what?
Temple of Doom is underrated, man.
It's overrated.
Overrated? Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you like Kingdom of the Crystal Skull better than Temple of Doom?
No.
Good. All right. Well, then we can still be friends. Moving on.
I do not.
So, yeah, I mean, that's
pretty much... Hey, wow, guys, just so you're listening, there's a very tough threshold to remain friendship with Zach, so hey, be careful out there. So I would just caution you on your comments to the Babel Conference. If you're really upset with it, just put my name on it or Zach won't respond.
Sir, if you think Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is better than any of the original Indiana Jones movies, we need to have a conversation. But moving on, what's our final tally here on these shuttlecrafts? Here we said 1.5. For this one, Ken.
Yeah, so that would mean 3.5 shuttles got destroyed.
Out of what?
Out of about 8 different things here. So that's not okay. Bad.
So almost half.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a good safety record, just statistically speaking here. You know, using Superman's words, it's not a great track record. There's been, there's shuttles that survive, but, you know, accidents, bad things happen, so.
Right. You know, I have not been on To the Journey. But if any of you To the Journey hosts are listening, I would like to invite myself over sometime to talk about the shuttlecraft on Voyager, because I have strong opinions about how many shuttlecraft that Scout-class ship on a short-term mission actually has. Because how many – seriously, I couldn't count how many episodes there are where Voyager loses a shuttlecraft. And for a show which was like could have really had a fresh angle on like conservation of resources and all, because we've been talking all throughout Star Trek, we're always talking about like, okay, there's no money, but like the replicators and like there's, you know, supply and demand, it's all very nebulous, right? But on a show like Voyager, where you can't go to a starbase and like refuel and refresh and get a new stock of shuttles and whatnot, They sure lose a lot of shuttles. I would love to talk about that with you guys sometime. So that's my open invitation to myself to be onto the journey sometime. So, you know, Zach, Suzanne, and Kay, let me know. And I would love to talk some Voyager shuttlecraft, because I have a feeling the ratio of Voyager is, until they get the Delta Flyer, they seem to hold on to that for a while. But before that, it's just like how many shuttles did Chakotay and Tuvok, you know, lose? That's, you know, just alone, just the two of them. I feel like they are responsible for losing pretty much half of Voyager shuttle complement. So
you know, you have a very interesting way of ingratiating yourself onto somebody else's show. I have to say that, you know, like, hey, can I come on your show to just tear it apart and have, you know, just show you why this is really dumb or whatever? Interesting. You know, good luck with that. I'm sure they're like writing down, hey, when can we get this guy?
Like, note to self, never let this jerk on our show. But like, it's all good fun, guys. As I, like, we try to keep it light, have a good time here on Center. Like, we're making fun of TOS, so it's all equal. hey, but, you know, it would be fun to be onto the journey. I haven't been on there with you guys, and I know Kay was on here not too long ago when I was gone. So thanks for guesting, and that was fun to hear your take on TOS. So I'd love to be over there sometime when I get a chance.
Well, you know, that in all seriousness, man, they are kicking butt over in that show. I mean, the numbers are great. They've got a great chemistry going. They've made it better than ever. So that is good. So maybe if they do need a little levity, if they want to bring to the journey to like that Star Trek V level, bring Zach on so we can talk about your shuttles.
Wow. Oh man, good stuff. So those are like the shuttlecraft proper. We see lots of travel pods and shuttles and motion picture, Star Trek 2, Star Trek 4, Star Trek 6. Mm-hmm. Usually the same shuttle pod, isn't it, Ken? Number five, right?
Number five, yep, 05. Yep. That they didn't repaint it, they just used, well, in the motion picture in Star Trek 2 is the exact same shot. You know,
stock footage. They just closed,
you know, they did a closer view of it. Star Trek 4, they're being escorted by some kind of little hot rod shuttle. Same thing in Star Trek 6. I don't know what it was, but it looked kind of cool. It's like the little Mustang shuttle, you know, it's got the spoilers on it and everything. Which is nice to be escorted. There's nothing wrong with that. And then, you know, in the new timeline movies, they use the shuttles quite a bit, you know, to get back and forth. And they are also very practical. When you said that the shuttle is kind of, you know, it's transportation. It's a space bus, so to speak. The 09 and Into Darkness shuttles reminded me of that, you know, even from the Kelvin itself to the use of, you know, getting aboard the Enterprise. They were very, you know, strap in with regular belt, you know, buckles and seat belts is what I wanted to say. All that kind of stuff. Very, very practical and very industrial. You know, they look worn out, used quite a bit. Very, very practical.
Yeah, that lived-in future look that people talk about Star Wars having a lot. Star Trek had it in the Kelvin timeline. You know, when Captain Rabaul goes through the shuttle, it has like those plastic strips of like, mm-hmm. you know, I equate it to like a freezer, like at a grocery store or something. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Like that just had a certain tangibility to it that I liked a lot. And yeah, the Kelvin timeline, again, talking about energy conservation, this or that, you know, when they send all the crews, you know, when they deploy the academy to go fill in these positions at all these ships, they're going off on shuttlecraft, you know, and right. You think to yourself, like, why? Like, why didn't they just beam everybody up? But is there only so much energy? Do you run out and then it just, the matter, antimatter replenishes itself? Like, I'm not sure what the science is. I haven't read The Science of Star Trek. I know that's a book. Maybe that's in there. But I'd be curious to know, how much can you actually transport, you know, without running out of power? Because obviously, you know, if, you know, in the original series, there was the transporter room. Mm-hmm. They call it the transporter room.
That's right.
TNG. I think it's in the Bynars episode, 11001001.
That one?
I think they talk about how they have, like, 20 transporter rooms or something because you're evacuating the ship. And so, like, transporter room 20 or something like that. I'm like, 20 transporter rooms?
Did they really have that many?
I think they did.
And you could use the cargo transporters, too, right? Which are different for some reason.
You could use the cargo bay. You could use the shuttlecraft transporters. There's so much you could do. But I think, you know, if you want to beam up, let's just say, obviously, the Kelvin Enterprise is twice as big as the original Enterprise. So let's say there's 800 people on it. You gotta beam up more than 6 people at a time. So they might have more than one transporter room. I'm not sure. But I think there is a certain there will always be a place for physical A to B transportation and not just teleportation. So.
Yep. Yep. It's, what were you saying? The amount of energy and, you know, we talk about Trekonomics and all that other stuff and the cost of transporting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The, Deep Space Nine, Cisco.
Oh, yeah. He had to save up transporter credits, right? To beam credits. Home to New Orleans.
Yep, yeah. Because yep. he was too afraid. Or he's just he was homesick at the space shuttle. Yeah. So, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, and that pops up even in the motion picture. You know, you zap over to the space station, transported to transporter room.
Regular zero,
right? Yep. But you can't transport from a transporter room to a ship. But the ships do it all the time. It is funny. The rules that get in place, and I think the Kelvin timeline probably plays with it the most, right? You know, you can snatch two guys that are falling from space, but they can't beam people off a moving garbage scow thing. It just the rules keep changing, or you can literally transport across the galaxy onto another planet. It is so all over the place when it comes to what you can and cannot do on a transporter. It's fascinating. But anyway, transporters are not what we're talking about today.
But we should talk about that another time, though.
I think we're on to something, beyond just a tangent. I think so, yes.
I think we have a couple of feature show ideas in this episode already. I have to listen back through it when we plan out our next month's meeting at our monthly meeting, Ken, where we decide what we're going to talk about, right? Because we plan these things out far in advance, don't we?
We do, and you know it's amazing too, because of all the funds that we get to do this, it's always fun. You know, Zach and I will often travel to like Bermuda, sometimes the southern coast of France or whatnot, to have these meetings, and that's how we come up with these great ideas. So I'm sure you know all the other shows do the same thing.
Yeah, we're sitting out there on the beach with a Corona, you know, maybe a Corona Light for yourself.
Well, you know, these are stressful times. I mean, it's not coming up with these brilliant ideas and incredible shows week after week is not easy. So, you know, we earned it. We absolutely deserve it.
Well, troubles with shuttles isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at what else you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
Who is that musician band, like that with the Greeblies?
The what?
Who are those weird looking neighbors that the Flintstones had? Like those monster neighbors? The Greeblies? Wow.
I forget. That's a deep cut right there.
I was about to say, dude, that's like 4 years old deep right there.
Yeah.
To the journey!
I kind of figured he would just be able to like make another mobile emitter for the doctor. Wouldn't he?
He'd use his nanoprobes for that.
Yeah.
Right, put some nanoprobes on the job, they'll make the doctor a new mobile emitter.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Lickety split.
Can I have my mobile emitter? Oh, yeah. He never asked, though, did he?
No, he didn't.
If he'd asked him, he'd just been like, oh, yeah, here you go.
Primitive culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
There is very much in Star Trek a kind of essentially moral worldview that is pertaining culturally in that world in the same way as, you know, say in the Arthurian court, you have this kind of moral world.
You sound like you're agreeing with Dr. McCoy that this is medievalism.
Nothing wrong with medievalism.
Well, as you were talking.
Good medievalism, you know.
Literary treks.
Yeah, you know, I think I made what little hints I gave in previous books about who had done it and why. I left sort of vague, but there were a couple of details that I had to hit because I'd seeded them in earlier novels.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And of course, in the Babel Conference, type Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek FM and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron on the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find the current goals and different milestone contributions along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our great associate producers for Standard Orbit: Norman Lau, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod.
Yes, thank you guys so much for your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So Ken, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Hey, you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference and engaging people when I have the opportunity. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BostonSCPO, and we like to tweet out all our new episode information as soon as we get it, as well as our colleagues. So look for me there.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter @MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman series from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter @AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.